Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we're going to recap some of our most intriguing and interesting Mind Moments podcast from 2024 with snippets from conversations that we had with experts in neurology. Let's dive in. Firstly, at the 2024 ECTRIMS Congress, the multiple sclerosis community was introduced to a newly updated version of the McDonald criteria, providing a new path towards the way we view and diagnose the disease. To better understand how these changes may impact clinical care, Neurology Live sat down with Cleveland Clinic's Dr. Daniel Antoneta, a staff member at the Mellon Center for Multiple Sclerosis. Here's Antoneta on the new biomarkers being integrated in the criteria, touching on central vein sign, paramagnetic rim lesions, and OCT.
So there's, you know, a couple additional biomarkers which are making their appearance in the criteria for the first time. Naturally, they you know, clinicians won't be as familiar with these as perhaps, you know, stuff they've been using from kind of when they were training. But I think there's a lot of data behind these. And, you know, the first one that is incorporated is the central vein sign. And the central vein sign is an imaging marker that demonstrates that lesions are occurring around a vessel. And we think this is pathologically specific because it reflects that demyelination occurs around these blood vessels, right? And, you know, a lot of people ask about, well, you know, it's kind of being used, you know, as a replacement, if you like, for dissemination in time, which actually doesn't have anything to do with time. It has everything to do with it being a specific measure of inflammatory demyelination. That is, when you see a lesion, when you see a brain where 50% or more of the lesions have veins going through the middle of those lesions, you are pretty sure that those lesions are lesions that are inflammatory demyelinating lesions. That doesn't occur to that frequency in other conditions. We've simplified the rule in order to call this, and it's something called Select 6, and we've done some work on this. And the diagnostic performance of this is really high. We demonstrated in there's demonstration in two studies, one study that we conducted with the North American Imaging and MS Cooperative, and one study that was conducted with a group out of the University of Nottingham in the UK, where it was clearly demonstrated that the central vein sign and abbreviated methods such as Select 6, counting six lesions that have a central vein on an MRI, had equal diagnostic performance or even better diagnostic performance than oligoclonal bands, which has been the test that we've, you know, historically used. And the second imaging biomarker that makes an appearance is the paramagnetic rim lesion. And, you know, paramagnetic rim lesions and central vein sign goes hand in hand because they're both based on a type of imaging called susceptibility-based imaging. Most commonly, those are detected with a sequence called SWI. That's a sequence that's used all over the world every day on MRI machines, easy to do. And while the central vein is something going through the middle of the lesion, the paramagnetic rim lesion is a small rim of iron susceptibility that occurs around the lesion. And it reflects that some of those lesions have a ring of activated microglia that also stain for iron. The iron is what makes it pop on that imaging sequence. And it's, once again, pathologically specific. Those lesions don't occur in under conditions. The specificity of pearls is even higher than the central vein. So this is a very, very specific biological marker. And how the diagnostic criteria codifies this is, you know, the presence of one or more paramagnetic rim lesion is considered positive. And it can be used in circumstances, for example, when you only have one topography. You can use either six central vein lesions that are positive or one lesion with a paramagnetic rim. And I think what that reflects is the fact that the most common lesion in multiple sclerosis is the deep white matter lesion. And the deep white matter lesion is not in the diagnostic criteria. It's never been one of the topographies. And the reason for that is because it's relatively nonspecific. That is, you have deep white matter lesions because of headache or because of vascular disease, because of a variety of conditions. But if you add the central vein sign, or if you add the paramagnetic rim lesion onto those deep white matter lesions, all of a sudden, then they, of course, become specific. And so, of course, in those patients who have less than one topography, having a paramagnetic worm lesion really will be important, right? Because that's something that's very, very specific. And I think it signals, something kind of more towards a fully biomarker-based diagnosis of MS, right? We've thought for years about, simplifying the diagnosis of MS. I'm an imager, of course, and I've worked in susceptibility-based imaging. So we've kind of thought about stuff like maybe you just need six central vein lesions and a rim lesion, and that's it. You can call that MS if you had the imaging techniques. So I think they're important, but I think there has to be some education done, both on the, radiology side of things. So the radiologist who interprets scans will have to become familiar with this. We are planning, as part of the North American Imaging and MS Cooperative, courses at the American Academy of Neurology, at the Consortium of MS Centers, at the American Society of Neuroradiology, so that we can provide some teaching on, how do you call a central vein sign positive lesion? How do you call a paramagnetic rim lesion positive? And which sequences can you do to view these? And they're, with a little bit of training, they're not that hard. So I think it's important that we kind of think also about the educational piece. Whenever you launch something new in the criteria, you need to make sure it's also backed up with some additional information. And then the last, diagnostic biomarker that kind of aids us is, the presence of OCT. So as I said before, the optic nerve now is a fifth topography, and how you demonstrate that the optic nerve is involved is in a variety of ways. You can do that on MRI, you can do that on visual evoked potential, and now you can also do that on OCT. So once again, there are also some kind of educational and technical things that we have to add into that OCT, but OCT is a tool that we use on a daily basis here at the Mellen Center. So it's only natural that now that's incorporated formally into the diagnostic criteria.
In early 2024, Biogen announced its voluntary decision to pull aducanumab, the first anti-amyloid treatment approved for Alzheimer's disease, in efforts to reallocate funds towards other programs. Ian Kramer, executive director of the Leaders Engaged on Alzheimer's Disease, or LEAD, coalition, sat down to discuss the lessons learned from the aducanumab saga and the insights gained on drug development in recent years.
For us at the LEAD Coalition, everything is an opportunity. We certainly are aware that there are a lot of challenges in the landscape, but we see tremendous openings to do better. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. So we all know that Lecanemab, as its brand name, is already on the market, has been for about 6 months. There's been some uptake, but we understand there are a lot of bottlenecks in the healthcare system that are slowing down access. Demand seems to be fairly strong, and I think will continue to grow. But we have to make sure that for patients who would like to pursue this, would like to get a workup to see if they're eligible for this therapy and work with their clinician, we have to make sure they can get to a qualified clinician, that clinician has system capacity within his or her practice, can get access to PET scanning, or is able to have a productive conversation about CSF testing as an alternative. That as a policy coalition, we do what we can to make sure that that appropriate biomarker tests are developed and then become available to clinicians so that their array of options to open up some of those bottlenecks becomes stronger. And then also that the reimbursement is there, so that it's not just there is a PET scanner and there's tracer available and the clinician knows how to order it, but that the clinician and his or her institution have confidence that the regional Medicare administrative contractors are going to reimburse in a clear and timely manner. So for us, you can say, well, those are all problems. We look at it as, we've got the door a bit open. Now we just need to work collaboratively with the clinical community, with policymakers, with public and private payers to open up those bottlenecks. And again, right patient, right treatment, right time. We're certainly never going to advocate that clinicians use a therapy or a diagnostic or a non-pharmacological intervention that they aren't comfortable with, or that their patients aren't comfortable with, or that wouldn't meet their needs. But where there's that match, we need to get the barriers out of the way and create opportunities for improve quality of life.
In the final months of 2024, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine published an update to its restless leg syndrome guidelines, making significant changes to the drugs and treatment management strategies for patients with the condition. These included a shift away from dopaminergic agents, greater emphasis on iron RLS pathophysiology, and the use of alpha-2 delta ligands and intravenous iron as first-line treatment. Here's Dr. Andy Burkowski, Vice Chair of the AASM Practice Guidelines Task Force, on how these guidelines will change the outlook of RLS treatment going forward.
One of the points I'd like to make is that even before you're looking at these treatments and the guidelines, we should all be looking at the good practice statement about ways of preventing the condition and behavioral and habit modification for dealing with symptoms of restless leg syndrome. We have the opportunity to create a new generation of individuals with restless leg syndrome who are not exposed to dopamine medications, which we're dealing with. So we're actually dealing with a more severe set of patients than we did maybe 25 years ago before these drugs were starting to be used. And a lot of these modifications to behavior prevention of the condition can be effective in those who have de novo restless leg syndrome. Things like good sleep schedule, good sleep hygiene, getting rid of vices, your caffeine, alcohol, nicotine that trigger restless legs, deprescribing some of the prescription drugs that worsen restless leg syndrome. So the future is bright because we're going to get a new generation that are not developing worsened conditions through augmentation from dopaminergic agents. And we'll be able to treat them with things like iron, which is more getting at the root. We're not treating the symptoms. We're getting at the root of the condition now. We're preventing the condition. We're getting at the basic pathophysiology. And then that will allow us to use these drugs less and less actually over time, because you'll have reduced cases of severe restless leg syndrome. So I think the future is bright. And then of course, the research moving forward, we do need more research and new treatments. We need to know how to address the people who are on the 60% who are on dopaminergic agents right now. What do we do with them? So there's a lot of unanswered questions, but I think we're basically starting over. And if we start over using these guidelines as our you know, to guide us both in the field of neurology, primary care, then I think you're going to have a happier population than you see right now, but maybe 15 to 20 years from now, when the new generation of people are treated with the right system in place.
The SYN1 diagnostic test may be an extremely critical piece of the diagnostic process for Parkinson's disease, helping distinguish it from other neurodegenerative and synucleinopathies. Earlier this year, Dr. Samia Hussein Wilson, a movement disorder specialist at Baptist Health in Florida, sat down to give an overview of how the test functions, its use in clinical care, and what clinicians should be mindful of during the diagnostic process.
So it's definitely a test that requires a team, because once we receive what are called the kits have to be stored properly. Once they are retrieved from storage, your assistant, medical assistant, nurse practitioner, what have you, is essentially there at the bedside, performing the procedure with you in a way I will explain. Once the patient arrives, there's paperwork that needs to be signed. Largely that paperwork is informative, meaning explaining a little bit about the details of the procedure, the majority of which I give once I walk in, explaining to them the details regarding, you know, when they can shower, how long they should take baths for, just to sort of give the skin punch sites some time to heal. They have paperwork they'll sign regarding their understanding of when they'll receive results. And that's essentially it, at which point I am called in. Once I call in, I review with the patient which side they would be more comfortable laying on, because they are laying on their side. I then explain to them that there are three punch sites. The three punch sites come from the trapezius muscle, so sort of a little bit lateral to that cervical region, the lateral thigh muscle, about an inch or two above the knee, and the lateral calf muscle, again, about an inch or two above the ankle. Once I have explained the sites, The patient has already been prepped by my assistant, so they're in a gown, they are laying on their side, and my assistant or whoever's assisting you will have set up all the necessary tools. Those tools involve everything coming from the kit, which involves the three tubes of formalin, which is what the specimens will be placed into. There's paperwork that annotates which side, almost akin to like a surgical procedure where you do a timeout, so you know you're doing right side versus left. Everything is labeled properly as far as right or left, which site we're doing. And then you have your surgical tools. We have, of course, needles that are already pre-filled by my assistant with lidocaine to numb the sites. We then have an instrument to actually perform the punch biopsy. We then also have a tool that allows us to excise the biopsy, if you will, from the punch tool, because sometimes they get a little stuck. And finally, we have tweezers to, again, you know, gently move that specimen into the formalin, at which point the cap is put on, it's set aside. And once all three formalin tubes are filled with specimens, the procedure's over. As each specimen is being taken, my assistant and I, we're administering wound care, if you will, by using either a 2x2 or 4x4, you know, stopping the blood loss, and then placing a bandage over the site. The procedure is now done. The patient is, you know, cleaned up in any way they need, alcohol pads, you know, maybe more 4x4s, 2x2s to, you know, clean up the sites. Gown is taken off, patient redresses. Again, it's explained to them that, you know, the site healing process and how long it may take. It typically takes about 3 to 4 weeks. We've seen anywhere up to 6 weeks for the site samples to be interpreted and then the results sent back to us, at which point we contact the patient and the patient is given whatever news they're going to be given, whether we have identified the proteins that we're looking for, which I know we're going to get into additional questions regarding alpha-synucleinopathies versus tauopathies and everything in between. And then that's when I really modify, you know, their appointment, meaning if I need to rush them in because, you know, this has served as a confirmatory test of what my clinical suspicion was, I will do so. If it, you know, doesn't, in whatever capacity, you know, their appointment may stay where it is or it may be pushed out. And there's a variety of ways that can play out in terms of what your clinical diagnosis is thought to be.
As the epilepsy field tries new innovative approaches to treating drug-resistant patients, stem cells are being introduced as another promising alternative. At the 2024 American Epilepsy Society annual meeting, Dr. Jonathan Parker, an epilepsy and functional neurosurgeon at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, sat down to discuss the thought process behind using stem cells to treat patients. Here's Parker on how this approach aims to restore neural balance and provide seizure relief without the cognitive side effects associated with conventional surgeries.
Well, I think it's a very exciting approach because it has the potential to be a regenerative therapy to treat our patients with epilepsy. So many of the therapies that we have in our surgical toolbox right now, including open temporal lobectomy or laser ablation, can be very safe and effective, but they are destructive, irreversible procedures, and they can come with some cognitive side effects for a subset of patients. And we get into a scenario where we know we can help a patient's seizures, but there are risks to cognition and memory. So all of us in neurosurgery, in neurology, epileptologists, we want to look to the future to see, can we do a therapy that actually can regenerate some of the abnormal neural circuitry, which is dysfunctional in epilepsy, and provide our patients dramatic seizure reductions or hopefully seizure freedom, and get them to the point where they don't have to have a destructive procedure. I think it's very exciting to look back to the sort of basic science of why we're interested in cell therapy at all in epilepsy. And I think it comes down to the fact that what we've learned over time, and this is not my work, but work of many, you know, if not hundreds of basic scientists and translational scientists over the last couple decades, is understanding this concept of the role of different neuronal subtypes and populations in epilepsy. And I think at a high level, we've come to understand that there's an imbalance between excitatory and inhibitory neurons. And I would say over the last decade, especially in mesial temporal lobe epilepsy, obviously one of the most common forms of adult epilepsy that we see, there's this imbalance of excitatory and inhibitory neurons. And what we've noticed, especially in a subset of patients that have mesial temporal sclerosis or an imaging finding of a sclerotic, globular, abnormal appearing hippocampus, there's actually loss of some of the inhibitory neurons, so-called interneurons, which make GABA neurotransmitter that tends to be inhibitory in most contexts. And we think that in the pathophysiology, that interneuron loss is important. So the hypothesis stood, well, there's loss of interneurons, and that's associated with the development of epilepsy. Can we repair, regenerate, or put in new interneurons to restore that abnormal function, restore that excitatory inhibitory balance to hopefully stop seizures or dramatically reduce them? So I think that's the preclinical rationale, and that's a lot of science that's come out of basic science labs and both small animal work and larger animal work, and now being translated into a first-in-human study for intrahippocampal transplantation of human interneurons.
At the 2024 American Association of Neuromuscular and Electrodiagnostic Medicine annual meeting, Dr. Lawrence Robinson gave a talk on educating the next generation of neuromuscular and electrodiagnostic practitioners. Robinson, a senior scientist at Sunnybrook Research Institute, highlighted some of the differences in this new generation of learners. Here he is, giving an overview of his presentation and why the topic of learning styles is so important to consider.
Yeah, I've been interested in education for a number of years. I train people, that's part of what I do, train people how to do electrodiagnostic medicine. And I've noticed that things have changed. So when I went to medical school, we had three sources of information. We had textbooks, we had lectures, and we had our clinical supervisors. And they were generally pretty reliable sources. The institutions that vetted them were reliable, and we could, you know, generally assume that what they told us was generally true. Today's learners are totally different. They have so many resources. They have expectations around immediate access technology. They just pull out their phone. They can pull up 100 or 1,000 different things. They can do a Google search. They watch videos. They have so many social media resources that it's a changed world. While they do have a lot more information, they also have conflicting information. How do you know that first page in your Google search is really what you should be looking at? How do you prevent confirmation bias, that your initial idea, you can find some article or some little posting that confirms what you thought? And today's learners are also confronted with a shorter attention span because they're used to little TikTok videos that, you know, it's not the same thing as reading a whole textbook chapter. And the TikTok video may not be the appropriate thing. And they have less ability to do critical thinking, which is a skill that's really needed for electrodiagnosis. So today's learners are very different. As a baby boomer, I think we just have to learn to change to meet the needs of today's learners. So that means using multimedia resources. It means teaching critical thinking in ways that we hadn't done before. It means using standardized testing in ways that we hadn't really relied on before, and ultimately just adapt with the times.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.